Welcome to Coffee First, the podcast about leaders and leadership. In each episode, we invite you to listen to a unique conversation about an individual's journey to understand what leadership is and how they've built their businesses around those learnings. We ask each guest to share those experiences and provide us with some reflections to put into practice ourselves. I'm your host, Adam Saunders, Managing Partner in the UK office and Global Board Member of AMROP, the executive search partnership shaping sustainable success through inspiring leaders. Today's guest is Kevin Kimber, a CEO with over 20 years leading and developing software companies. Kevin is currently Managing Director at Blackline, responsible for global AR. He joined the business in late 2020 when it acquired Remelia, a business he had led as CEO since 2018. This episode was scheduled to be recorded and released mid last year, but due to the then unknown deal, Kevin's increasing time commitments meant we had to push it back. After the deal was publicly announced, we agreed that the acquisition, however, would be an interesting dynamic to discuss on our theme of leaders and leadership. So finally, I'm glad to welcome Kevin onto the show for a chat. Kevin, it's great to see you.
It's great to be here, Adam, and looking forward to the chat.
Okay, so what we're going to try and do with this episode, as we do always, is look at leadership as a topic and try and see it through your eyes. So we'll start with a nice big question. A question we ask everyone immediately is, what does leadership mean to you?
Yeah, great. You know, top level leadership is about clarity. So clarity of purpose, clarity of mission, clarity of vision, and then how you coalesce people around that clarity. So top level, that's how I think of leadership.
Like everyone, leadership is something we experience firsthand from a very early age. We'll delve into your professional exposure to leadership. But before we get going, I know you were a very keen hockey player. Did sports in school or parents give you any early idea about what leadership is and how important it is?
So, I think like a lot of people, my early years was spent playing a lot of different sport, whether field hockey was my primary sport, but, you know, football, rugby, cricket, pretty much any sport I was excited to play. And in all cases, with any sport, you've got a coach, you've got a captain. And that's where I really cottoned on to this clarity of mission. You know, sport, clearly, the clarity of mission is crucial. So what are we trying to achieve? Where are we trying to get to as a group, either individually or as a team? And so I was lucky enough to play in some really top performing teams as I got older. And saw some fantastic examples of leadership. I also saw some fairly poor examples of leadership. Again, as you do, you know, when you're growing up, great coaches, you know, not so great coaches, and so you start to form an opinion of what is good, and actually you start to see it through. I certainly started to see it through the eyes of some of my teammates in terms of how did they respond. And it was one of the things that became really clear to me early on was not everyone responds to the same style of leadership.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. And leadership isn't just formed based on watching a leader do their thing. It's also based on watching how people react beneath them. And that forms the symbiotic relationship between, you know, leaders and their teams, right?
Yeah, exactly. And knowing when to deploy different types of leadership. So certain individuals will respond to, you know, a prod. Other individuals would respond to an arm around the shoulder. And seeing that and witnessing that early really was quite insightful for me, because it's not something I'd ever really thought about.
Mm. Okay, so that's your view on leadership. What drives you as an individual?
I think if you were to cut me to the core, the thing that fundamentally drives me is testing myself. So if you look back through my career, if you look actually outside my career as well, there's one consistent thread, which is put yourself outside your comfort zone and really test yourself. And unless you try, again, without talking cliches, unless you try, you're never going to know. And so one of the things that I've got very comfortable with through my career is being uncomfortable, you know, doing things that I've never done before to really test myself, whether I can do it, and also prove to myself that I can do it. You know, I think one of my core traits is that I feel like I have a point to prove. That's not a point to prove to anyone outside of, you know, it's not like I'm trying to prove a point to my parents or my siblings or my friends or my peers. in work. I'm actually trying to prove a point to myself that I can do these things. And that's still true today. And I don't believe will ever change.
Mm. When you look at your career, ServiceNow is clearly a really great decision and a great journey for you. But I'm curious to know, when you took that job, did you know it was going to be what it ended up being? And what was it that convinced you to join them at that point in the business's journey?
Yeah, it's a great question. So no is the short answer. We had no idea what it would become. I mean, when I joined ServiceNow, there were 9 people in North America and no one anywhere else in the world. And it was doing less than $1 million in revenue. And for anyone that doesn't know ServiceNow, it's the second biggest publicly traded SaaS platform with a market cap of about $105 billion. So, you know, clearly you don't go from 10 people, as was when I joined, to $105 billion market cap in one straight linear line. When I joined that organization, it was fundamentally, we felt, we being the 10 of us, we felt there had to be a better way. There had to be a better way in the market to do what ultimately ServiceNow did at the time. And obviously that's gone on to develop into a much broader platform. But you know, that is also a consistent thread through my career, that there has to be a better way, that, you know, being able to disrupt existing markets or bring to market new solutions is another core thing that I get excited about, motivated about, and like to line people up behind. Why did I join ServiceNow? So this was 2005 when I first met them, was fundamentally two people. So two brothers, Rob and Fred Luddy, who were the founders of ServiceNow. And, you know, to the point of leadership, I saw in those people, two people that I really wanted to work with. And that's another thing that's been, that's held true to my career. A lot of people look at what's the company, or even more people look at what's the role. And a lot of people get wedded to the package or the title. I've spent my career looking at people, and are these people that I believe I can work with? And are these people that I think can help disrupt things? And ultimately learn from. And so why did I join? It was those two individuals. And, you know, they are, as you might expect, great mates of mine today by virtue of the experience that we had together.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. And I'd like to dig into the point you just made about disrupting and there being a better way. And you said getting people to fall in line, you know, behind that idea, it falls into place of your sort of mission and vision piece. Did you go and find leadership? Because this is the job where you arguably had your first leadership role. Is that fair?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So did you seek out leadership, or did leadership actually seek you out because of these drivers that you have and the passion you felt for the business and the leaders above you?
I would say a combination. So, you know, from my formative years, you know, developing in sport, where I ultimately became a captain and then a coach and that sort of thing, it's something I think that I've always been attracted to, not from an arrogant perspective, but I like to set a tone. I like to set a strategy. I like to execute on that strategy, and I like people to ultimately line up and deliver that with me. I think as I was going through ServiceNow, naturally, you know, I was responsible for everything outside North America when I first started, which is a very big territory as one individual. And so, you know, you're doing that in your house. And then, you know, over time, we hired a couple of people, we opened an office. And, you know, naturally, as you're hiring those people, as you're onboarding those people, as you're training those people, they're looking for leadership. And naturally, as, you know, organizations scale internationally, you can't rely on leadership at HQ once you go beyond a certain size. So I think there was both a push and a pull, where I naturally was looking for the opportunity to do more. I also felt that I had a very clear view based on my alignment with the leaders, with the founders, that I knew what this needed to look like. So albeit that it was early in my career, I had a strong conviction around that. And so I was fortunate that they both gave me the opportunity. And, you know, I think I'd actively been seeking it through just some of the day-to-day activities.
Mm. Kevin, give us the quick 10-second overview of ServiceNow from its early days to IPO, the growth trajectory.
Sure. So in short, zero to 140 million. So we went from no customers, no revenue to 140 million of annually recurring revenue in a 7-year period. We IPO'd with a $4 billion market cap, and we achieved that all with very little funding. So it was my first experience of a rocket ship.
Yeah, wow. And of course, you know, we know that you achieved those great things. You were part of the team, part of the vision, but not long after that, you decided to leave. You took on another challenge, which falls neatly in line with your motivations and the way you view things. But I'm curious to know what led to that. Why did you make that decision? Because clearly things were going very well.
Yeah, they were going incredibly well, and I'd never experienced anything like it. I think, you know, what you've also got to think though about is through that 7 years, the company had become fundamentally very different. And I say that not as an issue. When you're there as 10 people and you're opening up international territories and you're doing things that you've never done before, you're learning on the job, you're experiencing good, bad, and indifferent things. Naturally, as we scaled, obviously more process comes in, more people comes in, the things you need to do change. And after 7 years, I felt that both personally, I'd taken it as far as I could. I also questioned whether I was mature enough to make the, mature enough to make the leap from a private company, public company. And, you know, over the 7 years that I was there, naturally, by virtue of the scaling of the company, my influence and my direct impact was devolved in some cases. And again, in hindsight, I question whether I had the maturity to cope with that. I mean, at the time of which we IPO'd, I was, that was 2012. So I was 34. And so I left 6 months after the IPO, as a number of the early 10 did, which also then is part of the reason why I left, because it felt like we'd taken it as far as we could at that point, and there was a requirement for a different leadership team to take it on, which ultimately they then did. And, you know, for us to go from 0 to 4 billion was beyond comprehension. For it to go from 4 billion to 105 billion as it is today, I still struggle to get my head around that.
Yeah. Okay, so you packed up your bags and you joined another growing business called Zuora.
Correct. When I think about, you know, disrupting markets and you know, ServiceNow was a well understood market with a number of dominant vendors that was ripe for disruption, i.e. there was a better way of serving that existing market. Zuora attracted me because it was ultimately trying to create a category, a new category. And so the founder of that organization, a man by the name of Tien Zwell, was very fixated on the world is going to move to subscriptions, which ultimately I think he's been proven to be correct, and that to manage a subscription business, you need different types of technology. And so I was attracted to both the opportunity of just the business where it was and what it was trying to achieve, but also being part of slightly more holistically, really changing not just an existing market, but ultimately creating a new market, which was something I'd never done before.
So Zuora turned out to be a different journey, but a very good learning experience. Why was it so valuable to you in your career, do you think?
So it was a very different journey. One, it was much shorter, and two, it was almost the complete opposite of what I'd experienced at ServiceNow. So ServiceNow, 7 years, an absolute rocket ship. Not to say that we didn't have bumps in the road, because we had many different bumps in the road and many different things that we learned along the way. Zuora, I actually ended up being at just under 18 months. And part of the reason for that was that ultimately at the time, it was an organization that was trying to create a category. And in Europe specifically, where, you know, ultimately I was focused in those early days, there was a lot less openness to change. There was a lot less openness to a new industry. And so I found that incredibly difficult. It was also very different in that, you know, ServiceNow had raised $7.5 million to get to 140 million. Zuora at that stage had raised $250 million to get to 30 million. And so, you know, it was a very, very different experience in terms of the VC involvement, and ultimately an opportunity for me to really be exposed to what does it actually take to create a new category. Because ultimately, which is something I'd never thought of previously, but if you're serving an existing category, in theory, you need a lot less capital than you do to create a new category. And so that I probably learned as much in those 16 or 17 months that I was at Zuora. I probably learned as much as I did in the 7 years at ServiceNow, but for very different reasons. It was very, very difficult in terms of scaling the business at that stage. And it was very, very different in terms of the investor dynamics and the sheer capital involved.
So you then take a completely different tack, right? You then join SAP, which is almost the opposite end of the spectrum.
And there was again both personal and professional reasons for doing that, as there would be with in any move. I mean, on the personal side, I'd never worked at scale. I'd never worked in large, complex organizations, and so to go from ServiceNow and Zora to an organization with 90,000 people all over the world was a complete change. And so, could I lead in that environment? Could I be successful? Could I get stuff done? You know, it's very, in theory, you could argue it's very easy to get stuff done when you're one of 10 people. It's a lot harder to get stuff done when you're one of 90,000. So on the personal side, that's why I went there. On the professional side, again, from a disruption perspective, you know, SAP was and is still trying to transform itself from, in theory, a legacy technology company to a cloud business. It made a huge amount of money, a huge amount of investment in acquiring some of the best cloud companies in the world, like SuccessFactors and Concur and others. And so I was attracted to go and run that business and fundamentally lead technology that I believed in, but in an organization that I'd never operated in, to test myself to see if I could be successful.
And what were the big learnings from that experience in final analysis, where you sit today looking back on it? What did the experience at SAP teach you?
So I was there for 3 years and grew the business fivefold over that time. You know, what I learned a number of key lessons. I mean, when you're working at that type of scale, SAP, Oracle, Microsoft, Amazon, those sorts of businesses, they have huge infrastructure, both from a leadership perspective, but also huge infrastructure in terms of training of people. So being able to pull on those sorts of things, being able to really help people in the broader sense was one of the things that I learned. But operating at scale and seeing that actually it's not that different, but also seeing quite a bit of lethargy when I first joined. So, you know, almost an acceptance that it would take a long time to get stuff done, whereas I come at it from a almost startup mentality. So if there's a process there that takes 2 weeks to complete, why can't we do that in 2 days? Or why can't we even do it in 2 hours? And so I was challenging the status quo a lot, not just on my own, clearly. A lot of people were doing the same. But I learned a lot through that period. I learned, interestingly, a very different experience from the client side. So at ServiceNow, our customers and Zora to a degree were almost evangelical. At SAP, you know, the customers were, you know, they'd had perhaps quite different experiences of deploying that type of technology, very large, very complex, very global in nature. And so working with some of those organizations gave me an exposure to a different type of customer leadership style. And then, you know, managing 1,500 people, that in itself was my ability to kind of seed responsibility into the group from a leadership perspective and actually trust your own leaders, because you can't possibly be over everything, was probably the biggest thing. The biggest difference I've experienced from a leadership perspective, it's one thing to go from being one of the team, an individual contributor, to managing individual contributor. That's one step. To actually go from being a manager of individual contributors to a manager of manager, and then a manager of managers of managers, those were shifts that I found much harder. And so in the 3 years that I was there at SAP, that was one of my key sort of learnings and experiences, as well as, of course, all the benefits that you get from big global corporates like sponsorship of McLaren and that sort of stuff, where you can get engaged in things that you wouldn't normally get exposed to when you're in startup world.
Yeah, absolutely. And if the pendulum had swung widely from Zuora to SAP, it swung even further on your next move, didn't it? Because you effectively went into business on your own for your next move. 3 years after joining SAP, you set up Kona.
Correct. And, you know, again, I had a great time at SAP, and I was fortunate that they were offering me bigger roles before I left. But ultimately, I decided that I wanted to test myself again, but in a different way. And this time I wanted to test whether I could start my own company on my own. And specifically, I'd noticed through the work that I'd done at ServiceNow at Zwora, and then even at SAP, that there was a big gap in the European investor community, in that in North America there's a blend really of both sort of formally trained banker backed or finance oriented investors and operators, so people that have run businesses, created businesses, whereas in Europe, and even today that's still true, in the investor community there's a lot of financially trained investors. There's typically less people that have run businesses, specifically technology businesses, and so I saw a gap that I felt that there was an opportunity for me to create a company to ultimately work within the exploding European ecosystem of technology startups and early stage companies, in essence as an advisor and an investor in my own right. And so that's what I did when I left SAP.
And so Kona for a couple of years was a vehicle for you to sit on a very different side of the business, because obviously the prior three roles, you were a manager, a leader of teams, employees, and then you become an advisor to businesses. So what did that teach you about leadership and yourself?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I think over the 2 years that I was doing it, I was looking at it because, again, I wanted to broaden my skills. I wanted to test myself in a new area. I'd never worked on the other side of the table from an investor perspective. I'd been involved in taking funding rounds. And one of the things actually that I learned first was actually what you think investors are looking at when you're raising money is very different to what they're actually looking at when you're on the other side of the table in the investor community. But from a leadership perspective, I think personally, one of the things I struggled with to start with, but then ultimately adjusted to over the 2 years, was when you're leading directly, whilst you are leading through influence, ultimately there's different types of leadership styles, and sometimes authoritarian is required, and therefore if you say this is what we're going to do, then that's what we're going to do. From an advisor perspective and a sort of independent board member perspective, you can offer the advice, but ultimately it's up to them to decide whether they want to take that advice or not. And so adjusting my style, finding other ways and influence to take people with you, if you had the conviction that was the right thing to do, was something, probably the biggest learning I had over the 2 years. The other big learning I had, interestingly, was actually I really missed the unification and alignment of a single mission. And so over those 2 years, I was probably never more than a day a week in the same place. And so your ability to impact in that way is different. And so one of the things I learned personally was I actually like to be very directly involved. And so so that's one of the reasons why I ultimately looked for that opportunity to step back in full time somewhere.
So how many boards were you sitting on during your time running Kona? How many advisory roles did you have?
So at its peak, I was touching 15 or 16 boards in various guises. So either as a formal board member, as an investor, as an independent, or as an advisor. At its peak, it was about 15 or 16 boards.
And as I mentioned in my intro, you end up becoming CEO of one of those businesses, which then goes through quite a major acquisition, which we'll come on to in a second. But tell us a bit about why Remelia stood out and why you ended up going for a leadership role there, because that's quite a big decision, again, to move from running your own business, being an advisor, to stepping back in. What led to that? And then what ultimately allowed you to make that decision?
I mean, one of the things, it's easy to assume that was always the plan. It was never the plan. It's easy to assume, well, you're going to sit there on the fence for a couple of years. You're going to sort of revitalize or address your personal things after an experience like SAP and ServiceNow and Zora. That was a treadmill for quite some time. It's easy to assume, well, you're going to sit on the fence for a period of time and then you're going to jump back in. It was never, ever the plan, or certainly not formally. Ultimately, Remelia as a business was a business that I got to know over about 15 months as an advisor. I'd spend a day a week with the business. It was a great group of individuals, and specifically, it was a market that was ripe for disruption. And so it naturally led very closely to my core, the core things that are close to my heart and that I look for in an organization. And then the investors asked me to step in as an interim CEO for a period of time with a view to hiring a full-time CEO, and candidly going through that process, being back in the driving seat, reignited a number of my personal motivations of wanting to do that sort of thing directly. I also saw the reaction of the leadership team and the way in which they responded to my style of very close and direct leadership. And also, speaking openly, when I was interviewing potential candidates for CEO, albeit that I'd not had CEO as a title on my CV before, I didn't feel like they were a massive step, and that's going to sound arrogant, it's not meant to sound arrogant, I didn't feel like they were a massive leap away from me in terms of experience. And so I decided that I wanted to really test myself. And so having come back from a trip to New York where I'd interviewed seven or eight potential CEOs, all of which were, you know, fantastic candidates, I had a very long and detailed conversation with my wife about my desire to step back in full time, and ultimately then went back to the investors with a shortlist of three candidates, two of which were of that group that I'd interviewed in New York, and a third which was myself, which was some curveball for the investors and something that I didn't anticipate doing prior to that.
And what was their reaction?
I didn't think you wanted to do that. I thought you were enjoying being an advisor, was the immediate reaction. And then we got into a conversation about what it was and, you know, more detailed conversation about why I thought that was appropriate. Why did I want to do it? What did I think I could bring? But what I said to them all along was, don't just put me into the role because you know me. I want you to put me in the role only because you want me to be in the role. And so I want you to run a formal process and assess me against these two candidates who in theory have more experience of me and they've done it before. And so again, testing myself, because ultimately then if I was going to manage the dynamics of that board with those investors, I didn't want a soft touch pass or soft pass into that role. I wanted it to be because they felt I was the best candidate for it.
So at that point, you'd been interim CEO for a number of months. Was it different going from interim to full-time CEO? Is there any meaningful change in you, the way you viewed yourself or the way the team viewed you, vice versa?
Yes, would be the short answer. I mean, I think on a personal level, I felt a huge sense of responsibility. So as an interim CEO, I was there for a period of time. As the full-time CEO, yeah, I'd never inherited 105 people whose jobs, careers, mortgages, families relied on those salaries. And so I found that actually quite an interesting and quite difficult shift in some respects to get comfortable with that idea. And then from a funding perspective, from a strategy perspective, okay, when you're interim CEO, ultimately you're keeping the lights on. Yes, you're making changes, but you're keeping the seat warm for the next individual, because that's ultimately what the investors wanted. When I'm then in the chair, okay, it's on me now. And I think the biggest thing that I found was missing that I ultimately very quickly had to fill is the mentor role. And so, you know, in all of my previous roles, I always had a mentor above me. When I was then became ultimately the person at the top of the tree, in that sense, I was the CEO. I then realized very quickly I still needed those mentors. I still needed people to sound, soundboard and bounce ideas around off. And that wasn't something that we had in our formal board structure. And so it was something that I discussed with the investors. It was something that we ultimately then looked at in terms of the board itself. But the board is a formal structure and in itself has obviously responsibilities. I also really quickly dug into the need for informal mentorship to ensure that when I was questioning things that I needed to ultimately execute against, that I had the ability to gain clarity of thought through other people, or test that clarity of thought that I might already have through other people.
And at the time, obviously being private equity backed, you knew that there were two outcomes that were going to happen in the next 5 years or so. It was either going to be a business sold on to perhaps another private equity fund, a larger fund, or there'd be some sort of a trade sale. Did that influence your day-to-day leadership of that business, knowing that you were ultimately heading towards one of these two potential outcomes?
No. Not in any way, because in like ServiceNow as an example, it was never about achieving an IPO. it was about disrupting a market. And our view was, and one of the things I've learned through my career is that ultimately that sort of stuff will take care of itself as long as you focus on the core fundamentals of the business. And so, you know, I never went into it with, I have to get this to a certain revenue figure with a certain gross margin so that I can then flip the business or whatever, or I have to achieve a certain return for the investors. It was, we have to disrupt this market. We have to grow this organization and the rest will take care of itself.
Yeah. I mean, so many people would consider the sale of a business or an acquisition of a business the zenith of a career. It's one of those things. Are you... You did that, and congratulations, by the way, on the deal.
Thanks.
In fact, if we're being honest, we were supposed to have recorded this particular episode last year, weren't we? And the deal was happening, and you said to me, actually, we probably want to wait a little while to do this.
Yep.
So thank you for that, and congratulations on the deal. But tell us a little bit quickly about how that deal came together and the, I guess, the challenges it presented to you as a leader as that deal started to clearly gather pace and momentum.
Yeah, so I think, and it's a really interesting question because there's two sides to that, obviously. There's the, I'd got the organization and my leadership team that I'd spent 12 months building out focused on a strategy and focused on executing that strategy. And so what I didn't want to do was disrupt that or even give people a thought that we were going to step away from that strategy to sell the business. And so the timing of bringing people into that discussion was critical. The way it came about, not uncommon, you know, Rimilia is in a really hot space, or Rimilia is in a really hot space. It's a hugely growing market. And therefore, as a result, there's a lot of interest from VC, private equity, and to some extent, trade as different routes. And clearly in my role as CEO, it was critical that I worked those different angles, even if I wasn't looking to raise more money, even if I wasn't looking to exit the business. You know, you never know when you might need to. And so that became a core part of my job. And we were approached a number of times by a number of different companies. And in all cases, it was a polite decline because we were growing really fast. We had clarity of mission and we were on our way, as it were. I was approached by Blackline initially in November of 2019 and then met them face to face in January of 2020, which interestingly is also the last time I got on a plane as a result of the pandemic. And I would normally be on a plane a lot. And so I met with their founders, their founder CEO and their CFO in Los Angeles last year, and found an organization that was just on two vectors really, really interesting. So in terms of how they thought about customers, how they thought about their employees, almost complete alignment. And candidly, it felt a lot like ServiceNow, which naturally drew me to it. But then as I thought about how we would scale the company and the options in front of me, do I go and raise more money? Do I potentially consider something like this with Blackline? And ultimately, how do I secure the future of the business, secure the future of my employees' careers? And how do I deliver a step change in this market? How do I disrupt this market in a more meaningful way? Ultimately, I decided that the way to do that would be through the acquisition. So it wasn't a personal motivation that I wanted to exit the business, or it wasn't being driven by the investors. It was ultimately an alignment of, there's a huge opportunity to leapfrog probably 3 or 4 years of standalone work, and in doing so, really disrupt this market, really bring to bear the technology that we have and put it in the hands of a distribution channel that we could only dream of. And so we went overnight from an employee base of 105 to 1,200, a customer base of 150 to 3,500. And therefore that was unifying.
And you went from being the CEO of a business to part of a leadership team underneath another leader. So how was that dynamic? That's quite a shift, because overnight everything's changed. And was that easy for you? Did that catch you by surprise, or was it enjoyable?
So I've always had a view that the company is your current job and your role is your current assignment. And so if that makes sense. And so I'm fairly fluid in that sense, that I'm not wedded to a title. I'm not wedded to anything like that. I'm more focused on, so how can I deliver impact? And therefore, in this scenario, yes, of course, there's an adjustment to changing to having a boss. I would say that Blackline have managed that transition with a huge amount of empathy and an awareness of that type of adjustment, not just for me, but my other leaders. But also from my personal perspective, I can have more impact as part of Blackline than I could have had, you know, as CEO of Rimilia. And that might sound like a strange thing to say, but I've now got 3,500 companies that I can get our technology into the hands of where appropriate. I've got SI, or, you know, the likes of EY, KPMG, Deloitte that want to work with us that wouldn't have worked with us as part of Rimilia. I've got all sorts of avenues that I wouldn't have had available to me. So therefore, it's, yes, my title's changed, but my fundamental role hasn't changed. My mission hasn't changed. If anything, I'm securing the likelihood of success of that mission. And therefore, that's my focus, because I can still have the same amount of impact.
Yeah, I totally get that. I hear you. And again, I think that's a common theme amongst good leaders. Give us a quick overview then of what that deal was and where the business is today.
Sure. So Rimilia was acquired by Blackline on October the 2nd. I learned a huge amount through that process. I mean, we did the whole deal through lockdown. So it was all done via video calls and everything else, which was interesting in itself.
And I'm curious, did that improve? Did it make things more efficient? Do you think it made the process hard? I know you haven't done one of these processes before, but do you think that it was a quicker, more efficient process, or did it lack something because you couldn't get on planes and meet each other?
I think, yeah. I mean, ultimately, the social informal alignment wasn't there. You know, every session was as much as you might open it up with a few minutes of chat. In reality, you were there for a purpose. I'm here to provide a certain amount of information or provide answers to certain questions or whatever. So it was very efficient in that sense. But, you know, the ability for, you know, the informal around those sorts of sessions wasn't there. So you weren't having a coffee in the corridor in between sessions, or you weren't going out for dinner and that sort of stuff. So the informal alignment of individuals was not so much, it wasn't a challenge, but it was just a gap. It was a mist. So that was interesting. But yeah, you know, the deal closed on October the 2nd. We sold the business for $150 million, which, you know, is only relevant as a size based on obviously a number of metrics in terms of the business, which I don't think we need to go into. But it was a fantastic outcome for the company, a fantastic outcome for Blackline. The investors were very, very happy. And so, you know, it felt like absolutely the right home for the company and the right home for the employees and the right home for the technology. And so when you've got that type of alignment, you got to make it happen. Ultimately, it felt like the biggest deal of my life. Even though I've been through the IPO, even though, you know, I've done many other things and been fortunate to experience many different things, it felt like the biggest, most complex deal of my life.
Is that because you were holding the reins, do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I felt a huge amount of pressure to deliver that deal because I was so excited about the potential of the, you know, the two organizations together, the potential for our staff, the potential for the technology and the distribution channel that Blackline offer. And so I felt a huge amount of responsibility to deliver that deal. It was ultimately on my shoulders and that of my CFOs.
Mm. Well, look, like I said, congratulations. It's a huge achievement at such a relatively young age. Most people don't get to see that sort of deal, let alone do it as quickly and as well as you have. We're slowly getting towards the end of our chat. So I have a couple of questions just to round off before we get into some of the fun stuff.
Okay.
Do you think anyone is ever the finished article when it comes to leadership?
No, without question. I mean, it's the reason, you know, and it's a cliche, but it's the reason why, pick a sport, but the best sports people have a coach, because you can always get better. It's the reason why captains of industry have a coach, have a mentor, have an infrastructure around them, because they can always get better, partly because the world continues to change. So someone that was great yesterday isn't necessarily great today because something might have changed.
Fantastic. That's really great. Look, I think we've spent as much time as we can going through in the broadest possible way your career. There's, as you said,
so much more to discuss. And maybe we'll have an opportunity to do that with you again in the future and dig a little bit deeper. But for the time being, let's leave the career bit aside. Let's try and learn a little bit more about you. We have this section where we ask our guests questions just to get perhaps a better understanding of them as an individual. So if it's all right with you, I'd love to just go through some rapid fire questions with you.
Okay, I'm ready.
Ready. All right. Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Which sort?
Black decaf.
Oh, okay. Now that is a very contentious answer. There are a lot of people listening now who might be saying that is not coffee. How do you feel about that?
I feel fine about that. I love the taste. I took a view about 6 or 7 years ago that I was drinking too much caffeine and I was eating too much sugar. And so I went on a detox from both. I've naturally replaced sugar in my diet very quickly, but I've not drunk caffeine since. And that's not some self-righteous, I don't drink caffeine. I just haven't done. I feel more alert as a result, feel more even as a result. And I just drink, but I love the taste of coffee. And so what is funny about it though, is when you're traveling around the world, the reaction you get from people's faces when you order a decaf. In France and specifically Sweden, when you ask for a decaf coffee, you get you get looked at in a very certain way, which I've had to get used to.
Awesome. Book or Audible?
Book.
Interesting. And when do you read? When do you find time to read? Because most people struggle with books at the moment and say Audible because of time management. So when do you typically read?
I don't read as much as I'd like, but I try to end every day with 15 to 20 minutes. It's about all I can cope with before I go to sleep. But I actually find it a really good way of emptying my head from the day so that I'm not laying in bed thinking about things. And so 15 to 20 minutes at the end of a day, I'll read 10 pages or whatever of a book. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
It's a straight win for dogs so far. Nobody has said cats yet.
Well, I'm allergic to cats for one, and I don't. Apologies for anyone that likes cats. I don't see the point of them. So they're too independent.
they're not compliant enough. Is that what you're saying?
No, I just love going for a walk with a dog. Cat walks itself.
I agree with you. Pure evil. Instagram or Twitter?
Instagram.
Apple or Android?
Apple.
Morning or evening?
Morning.
What time do you get up?
Depends, but normally about 6 a.m., 5:30, 6 a.m. And then I do my best work in the morning. I know it's a cliche, but I do.
Okay. Gig, concert or theatre, when we're allowed to go to them?
Gig.
And who would you see? Who's top of your list?
Oh, that is a good question. I love any form of live music, which sounds like a cop-out answer, but I'm as happy listening to somebody that's an amateurist with an acoustic guitar as I am, you know, a stadium concert or a festival.
What's your most treasured possession?
My grandfather's armchair.
Oh, that's lovely. What is the last book that you read or listened to?
The Yvon Chouinard Patagonia book.
Let My People Go Surfing.
Correct.
In fact, you recommended that book to me, didn't you?
I did, yes. And it's a very good book.
There's one more question.
Okay.
Okay. We always ask everyone to recommend a book to anyone that's listening, a book that is important to you for whatever reason. It can be whatever you wish. Which book would you recommend someone reads?
One of my favorite books I've ever read, because it transcends a number of things that I'm interested in, is Shoe Dog by Phil Knight.
Oh, that's another popular answer, which is an excellent, excellent book.
Yeah. My love of popular culture, my love of trainers, my love of Nike, my interest in business, it transcends all of those. That is a great book that probably of all the business books I've ever read, it doesn't feel like a business book because it's a really interesting tale.
Yeah, brilliant answer. In terms of charity work, mm-hmm. you're involved in a couple of things. Which one is most important to you, most special to you?
One of the things that's most special to me in life is children and early experiences. And so I'm involved with a charity called Apps for Good, which is all about inspiring the next wave of entrepreneurs. And so encouraging children of all ages, from as young as primary age up through secondary and sixth form, to ultimately try and enlighten their entrepreneurial spirit through the use of technology. And so that's something I'm really passionate about and something I really enjoy.
Excellent. And how can people learn more about that charity? And how could people get hold of you if they're interested more in your business endeavors and want to get in touch with you that way?
Sure. So Apps for Good is, you can get online at appsforgood.org or through my LinkedIn profile, which is answer to your second question. So Kevin Kimber on LinkedIn, you'll find Apps for Good in my profile. So that will give you both access to me and them should you want to do that. Or indeed, you could email me at kevin.kimber@gmail.com.
Kevin, thank you very much. We've reached the end of our episode. It's been really, really great chatting to you, listening to your story. Thank you so much. There's lots we didn't cover, as always, but look, thank you for giving us your time and thanks for sharing your story with us here.
I've really enjoyed it and thanks very much. And yeah, have a great day. Cheers, Adam.
Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Coffee First. Please don't forget to hit the subscribe button, follow our Twitter account, CoffeeFirst13, and follow the Amrop UK LinkedIn page for all company updates. We look forward to inviting you back for the next episode of Coffee First.